ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
Throughout my career, I have been asked how I kept going in the face of such horror, such resistance, and such politics. My answer is simple. I drew strength from the people whose rights we defend. It is they who taught me that human rights work is never about despair. It is about persistence. We do not have the luxury of giving up because injustice never takes a day off.
Her grandparents were indentured labourers in apartheid South Africa, but she grew up to become the first non-white judge in South Africa's High Court, and later the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. She served on the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, prosecuting perpetrators of the African nation's horrific genocide in 1994, during which time she worked to establish sexual violence and rape as war crimes, a major breakthrough. And as a beacon of international law and justice for six decades, she is not slowing down. Recently, chairing the UN Commission of Inquiry that concluded Israel was committing genocide in Gaza. Today on Big Ideas, the trailblazing winner of the 2025 Sydney Peace Prize, Judge Navi Pillay, on what it takes to stand up against the horrors of humanity. She is speaking on Gadigal land.
Good evening, everyone. I'm truly impressed by the size of this crowd, which means I have to speak louder. So I hope you can hear me on this then. So I would like to acknowledge that we are gathering on Gadigal land, and I pay my respects to elders past and present. I was here in Australia about 15 years ago as High Commissioner for Human Rights, leading a UN delegation here. And I dutifully made these acknowledgements in every one of my speeches. So I'm really wondering why you haven't gone further than a mere acknowledgement. So I salute the states of Victoria who have drawn a treaty, and I hope yes, and I hope that it'll be national soon. So I am so much into International Criminal Court. Dare I mention that what you are acknowledging is an international crime. But standing here today, I am reminded how improbable this journey of mine has been, from the dusty streets of apartheid-era Durban to the halls of the United Nations in Geneva and to this hall and the award. My story, in truth, is not only my own. It belongs to all those who believed that the law, even in the darkest times, could be used as a beacon of hope. I was born, you know, it's in my speech, my daughter put it in, yes, so I have to give you the age then. Yeah, well, so she has, yeah, I was born in 1941 in segregated South Africa, the daughter of Indian Tamil parents who worked tirelessly so that their children could have an education. So my grandparents were brought by the British as indentured laborers to work in the sugarcane fields. As you know, Mahatma Gandhi called their conditions of labor as semi-slavery. But what I want to stress that within three generations, there's the grandparents who are laborers. The next generation, my parents had jobs. My father was a bus driver, my mother a homemaker. We did not have much, but we had values, dignity, faith in education, and the conviction that every person, no matter their color or gender, deserves a chance. So I credit that community of very poor indentured laborers who thought of building their own schools, so that within three generations you have this dramatic change. In my own family, we have two judges and two school principals. Now, under apartheid, that belief of discrimination was radical. The system told us every day that we were less than others. Schools were inferior, opportunities limited, and our very movement controlled. I grew up watching my parents and neighbors live with quiet resilience, even as laws denied us basic rights. When I decided to study law at the University of Natal, few women, especially women of color, chose such a path. I should pause here to tell you how I got to university. Well, my school teachers went around my poor community of Clarewood and told them, as they went door to door, that here we have a student who has potential and she should be sent to university. All those poor people, who I'm sure would much rather have used their pennies to support their own children. Yes, they could donate it to let me go to university and supported me for 3 years there. I had many opportunities to repay and thank this community, and I told them, you sent me to university, and then I went further, and I want you to know how I've delivered on your trust. So they were very interested in all the international tasks that I had undertaken. The law as it was written protected apartheid, but I believed that law could also be a tool to fight injustice from within. And when I graduated, no white law firm would employ me, so I did what I had to do. I opened my own practice in 1967, the first non-white woman to do so in Natal province. And even my non-white colleagues said that's being very presumptuous because women cannot manage a law firm. I want to pause here briefly to say to you, you know, so Mandela describes his experiences in 1941, and mine are 25 years later. He writes that he was fortunate to be accepted as a candidate attorney in a white law firm, but they told him, in order to be successful as an African lawyer, you have to know your place. And you see the teacups that are there, those are for the white staff. You have to bring your own tin mug to drink your tea. So I found 25 years later, when I knocked on doors for jobs, I was trebly discriminated. One, on class, that you are poor. Does your father have lots of money? Can you introduce business to the firm? And on race, that we can't have white secretaries take instructions from a black person. And on gender, you are married, what if you have children? Now, no young woman would put up with those levels of discrimination. That's why we have to credit all the women ahead of us who made these dramatic changes. I spent 30 years as a defense lawyer in South Africa. I defended women and men who were imprisoned for standing up against apartheid. I represented detainees who were tortured, families who could not find their loved ones, and political activists brought before courts designed to silence them. Many of those cases never made headlines. Sometimes I lost. I carefully say sometimes, most times I lost, because the law itself was unjust. But even then, I believe that every small act of defiance mattered. Practicing law under apartheid was an education in courage. It taught me that injustice is not abstract. It has a human face. It is a mother waiting outside a prison gate, a child denied schooling, the man whose confession was beaten out of him. It was for those people that I chose to stay, to fight within a system that sought to exclude us. You know, the common phrase was, you can't get any justice in the apartheid courts. And Nelson Mandela said so years before. And that was, he was charged under the Racial Hostilities Act. And he refused to plead guilty or not guilty. And he said, this is a white man's court. I don't expect justice here. The magistrate said to him, yes, that's a fact. This is a white man's court, and that's the way things will be, as if it will stay forever. So I myself didn't believe that we will get any change from apartheid to democracy in my lifetime, but we did, mainly because of collective action from civil society all over the world, including Australians. I want to give you a little idea of what kind of cases we did in the early days. So I'm talking about 1965 and so on. I know most of you are thinking we weren't born then, yes? So I was an article clerk to a lawyer who was banned and house arrested, and he couldn't leave the city of Durban, and he had to be home by 5 p.m. every day. And I was just out of university, knew nothing about court work, and I was doing these important cases, one of which was right in the rural areas in Zululand, and I was there to defend an African farmer who was charged for failing to dip his cattle. I think you understand about dipping. When I'm talking in the States, they don't know what I'm talking about. So I presume for health reasons, you have to dip your cattle. And he came in from a very long way. You know, when he came into court on time by 9, but he had left home at 4, coming from his home, walking all the way to get there. And as the case started, I realized the state witness said that the dipping wells were broken at the time. And so I quickly said to my client, you know, we can get out of this. If the wells are not working, how do they expect you to dip your kettle? You can get away with it. So let me say that. I said, I'll close the case and I'll say that. You know, you're talking about a 22-year-old lawyer doing a case for the first time. And he said, no. I'm going to go into the witness box and explain. He was part of the defiance campaign started by the African National Congress under Chief Albert Luthuli, and they were deliberately refusing to dip their cattle. And he wanted to say that. He went in the witness box, made his speech. The magistrate and prosecutor loved it because now there's a willful disobedience of the law. He was sentenced to a fine. They confiscated his cattle. He had to pay this lawyer first to travel there and then for the defense. I learned immediate lessons from people like that because I had been taught by white lecturers at Natal University. This is the real life. And this is, his conduct to me was the stuff of heroes.
And those seeds of heroism were sowed in a young Navi Pillay, who joins you today on ABC Radio National's Big Ideas. Hello, I'm Natasha Mitchell, as recipient of the 2025 Sydney Peace Prize. Now aged 84, Navi Pillay is reflecting on her long career from fledgling lawyer to the benches of international justice.
So when democracy finally came to South Africa, it was not the end of the struggle, it was a new beginning. In 1995, I was appointed as an acting judge of the High Court, the first non-white woman to serve on that bench. And I should tell you that I had this early morning call on a Saturday morning on the phone in my kitchen, and the woman said, "Hold on for the president." And I thought, it must be my brother playing the fool. But it was President Mandela. And he said to me, "Congratulations. It gives me great joy. And I hope it'll be permanent soon." And of course, I could not speak, couldn't utter a single thing. People often ask me, "Well, why didn't President Mandela appoint you?" Well, there's no way I'm going to ask him that. Besides that, I got tongue-tied. But walking into that courtroom for the first time as a judge, I thought of all the people who had been denied justice there. I hoped that my presence would symbolize a new era, one in which justice could finally serve everyone. And in that same year, President Mandela himself nominated me to the United Nations General Assembly, where I was elected as a judge at the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. This was the second ad hoc tribunal that the UN Security Council set up. The first one was for former Yugoslavia. And 1 year later, the Rwanda Tribunal. The genocide in Rwanda has shocked the conscience of the world, where close to 1 million were slaughtered in 100 days with handheld machetes that were not manufactured in Rwanda. When I arrived in Arusha, Tanzania, where the tribunal was based, there was no precedent for what we were about to do. We were building international justice as we went along, and the work was harrowing. We listened to survivors recount horrors beyond imagination, women who had seen their families murdered, children orphaned, entire communities destroyed. It was in that setting that we made this historic decision in the case of John Paul Akayesu, the mayor of Taba. We ruled that rape and sexual violence of Tutsi women could constitute acts of genocide. And all this was based on the evidence that we had heard. But it was the first time that an international court recognized that women's suffering in war was not incidental, it's not collateral damage, it's not trophies that the soldiers can take away. It was deliberate and it was criminal. And it's true that judgment remains one of the most meaningful moments of my career. Let me say, I was the only woman on that bench. My two colleagues were male from Senegal and Sweden, but guess who? The defense lawyers took on appeal to the appeal court. Yes, the woman judge. That I was biased, that I was influenced by the women protesting in Kigali. So I throw that in to tell you it follows us all the time, this discrimination. So for centuries, though, women's pain in conflict had been ignored or dismissed. In that courtroom, survivors' voices changed the law. And I will never forget their courage, their insistence on being heard. So I have limited time, but I would love to tell you how this definition has been followed, adopted in the Rome Statute, adopted by two states in the United States, adopted in my own country, South Africa, because it is a gender-neutral definition, and it could happen to men and women because it's a invasion of a person of a sexual nature under coercive circumstances. We studied the definitions of most countries. Germany had a good one, but we common law countries, that's Australia, South Africa, UK, yeah, we still had the old British laws that rape involves the penetration of the penis in the vagina. So the Constitutional Court had a case before it where a boy child had been sexually abused and the sentence was much lower than if it had been a girl child. And they thought the suffering of the victim is the same. Justice Goldstone, Richard Goldstone, our judge on the Constitutional Court and who was the first prosecutor at the ICTY, told me that he alerted the Constitutional Court judges to look at the Akeyesu definition, and that's how it was followed. So in time, the other 14 judges elected me president of the tribunal, and I was pretty pleased. I thought merit being recognized at last. Yeah, no, sorry to say, one of the judges said to me, we elected you because you're a woman and we know that you women work very hard. So, as president of the tribunal, I learned that justice is not just about punishing perpetrators, it is also about restoring dignity to victims, which was missing in those statutes. There was no reparation and no help for the victims. And yeah, we were spending millions to prosecute a few people, but leaders of the Rwandan genocide. So we worked to make proceedings fair, to document the truth, and to show that even after atrocity, the law can have the last word. After nearly a decade at the tribunal, I was elected as one of the first 18 judges of the International Criminal Court in The Hague. And once again, I found myself at the frontier of legal history, helping to establish a permanent world court that could hold individuals, not states, not armies, not parties, but individuals accountable for the gravest crimes known to humanity. And what I was able to contribute in the International Criminal Court is to spell out the rights of victims, because that statute recognized the rights and dignity of victims. So they had a right to participate in the proceedings. They had a right to have a counsel representing them, and they had a right to, they had a say in the crimes that were being charged and so on. So that is also very new. It's absent in our systems. So I think international law is well placed to influence national judicial systems. But justice is not only global, it must also be local. It must reach the person in the village, the woman in the camp, the prisoner behind bars. Law that does not touch human lives is not justice, it is paperwork. And this is why I respect these rights that we spelt out in the International Criminal Court. They also have an expanded list of sexual crimes. I wouldn't call them new crimes, but they are crimes that have been criminalized for the very first time, such as sexual enslavement. In 2008, I took up what would become the most visible and politically complex role of my career as United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. When I walked into that office in Geneva, I understood the weight of the task and how different that was. As a judge, I was judgmental. Here, I had to be an advocate and get conversions to more advances in protection of human rights. I was the first woman of color, the first person from Africa to hold the position, and I always had, I was the first woman who came from civil society and NGOs, so really I thought and acted differently from really all the appointments, almost all the appointments at the high level at the UN who are former heads of state or foreign ministers and so on. But my job as High Commissioner was to speak truth to power, often to the very governments that funded our work. It was not an easy assignment. Human rights is never comfortable for those in authority. I spoke out on Syria when others remained silent, on Sri Lanka when truth was inconvenient, on discrimination against LGBT persons when some states said these were not human rights issues. Don't introduce new human rights here. I said then, and I repeat now, the universality of human rights means just that, universal. No one is excluded and no one is above accountability. Some of the things I'm proud to have done while High Commissioner for Human Rights is, for the very first time, place caste-based discrimination on the agenda, because India had effectively kept that issue out from the Durban Racism Conference and from the UN, and they protested very loudly to me. Don't bring caste in, that's an internal matter for India. In fact, caste is our word. And I said to him, no, I've now met people from Japan, from Nepal, from Mauritania, who all suffer caste-based discrimination. So that's on the agenda for the very first time. And I also helped put on the agenda the rights of indigenous peoples and supported their first world conference at the United Nations. During my tenure, I traveled to refugee camps, prisons, and conflict zones. I met victims of torture and survivors of sexual violence. Their stories haunted me, but they also inspired me. I wanted the world to see their humanity, not just their suffering. I believed and still believe that the job of a High Commissioner is not to comfort the powerful, but to give voice to the powerless. You know, they haven't strictly put me on time yet, so I can go into another story. I want to describe to you that I led a delegation as High Commissioner to South Sudan, the world's most recent state, and we went by UN helicopter to the north, the Blue Nile area, and there my staff had prepared for me to meet with a number of women. We sat under the trees with the Nile mud under our feet. That's the best we found. And there were groups of women from different tribes. They didn't speak the same language, so there had to be interpretation in four different dialects. Two of the women stood up, and before I do that, let me say, then I looked at the women. Some of them had all their four front teeth missing. That's the way they branded them, like you brand cattle, to indicate which tribe they belong to. And of course, they had all these various gashes on their face. That's another means of branding them. So two of those women described to me that their husbands and sons were entering their daughters, their 15-year-old daughters, into marriage in exchange for cattle. To very old men, in exchange for cattle. The girls refused, and these fathers then killed their daughters. And the mothers say, we know where they are buried, in our backyard. We informed the police, but nobody has done anything about it. Do we, who bore these children, not have any rights over them? And so, you know, I gave them a lecture on rights and human rights. Everything belongs to them. But as I left there, I thought, I felt a sense of hopelessness. You know, this is just so far away from what we're talking about high up there in Geneva. Until a week later, the ambassador of South Sudan came to see me, and he had a big smile on his face. And he said, something has happened in South Sudan that has never happened before. Those women whom you addressed got together and went to see the governor of their state and demanded, we want our rights. You know the importance of that it's about them. It's about the people we speak to. We have to encourage and let them know that they can. They have rights and they can assert it. There will be people who would help support that. But throughout my career, I have been asked how I kept going in the face of such horror, such resistance, and such politics. My answer is simple. I drew strength from the people whose rights we defend, from the Rwandan woman who testified despite her trauma, from the Sri Lankan mother who refused to accept her son's disappearance, from the activists and lawyers who risk their lives every day to demand freedom. It is they who taught me that human rights work is never about despair. It is about persistence. We do not have the luxury of giving up because injustice never takes a day off. Looking back, I see the time. I knew they'll try to stop me. Yeah. So looking back, I see that my journey has been shaped by three convictions. First, that the rule of law is the foundation of a just society. Second, that women's rights are human rights. And third, that human dignity is universal. I have seen that affirmed in the eyes of many so-called victims. No one's dignity depends on their nationality, religion, gender, or whom they love. Our shared humanity is what binds us, and defending that humanity is what gives our lives purpose. So these are the things that motivate me and continue to motivate me right now. It's you who motivate me. Thank you very much for your reception.
The incredible achievements of Judge Navi Pillay, reminding us of what international law can achieve when it's working well. And she has been recognised for this work with the 2025 Sydney Peace Prize, awarded each year with a special event at the Sydney Town Hall, which we're bringing you today on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National. Great to have you company. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Judge Pillay was the first non-white judge in South Africa's High Court and the former United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. At 84, she is not slowing down. Most recently, she chaired the United Nations Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, which concluded that Israel was committing genocide in Gaza. Also part of that investigation was former Australian Human Rights Commissioner Chris Sidoti. And to discuss the findings, they're both joined now by Rowan Araf, founder and executive director of the Australian Centre for International Justice. And asking the questions is the host of Guardian Australia's Full Story podcast, journalist Noor Haider.
Congratulations once again, Navi. It is an award richly, richly deserved. I will begin with you. You are stepping down from your role as the head of the commission. I believe that might have already happened formally. At a time where international law and the multilateral systems set up to uphold those laws have failed to prevent the most extreme violence and atrocities, which many here tonight would have seen and witnessed live or in near real time on their phones. Where do we go to from here? Can these global systems recover?
Well, thank you for that question. Many, many people are troubled by the events, especially seeing 2 years of killings going on nonstop in Gaza. And they've questioned me. What's the point in you coming up with a report? We are all witnesses to what's happening. We saw it on our TV screens. So what now and what action? Firstly, let me point to the people's reaction all over the world, including your march on the bridge here. Civil society all over the world, and in my country in particular, in South Africa, vehemently protested and insisted that their governments intervene. I'm very happy that South Africa is leading the action in the International Court of Justice. complaining about Israel's conduct constituting a violation of the Genocide Convention. Now, that's a good example of what states can and must do. These laws, the Genocide Convention was not drawn by us. It was drawn by the states. It was 1948, of course. Most of you were not around. I was seven. They wouldn't have had me there here. But the states drew it. And why did they do that? They said genocide is such an abominable crime, it must never be allowed to happen. And so there is a legal obligation on every state in the world, to prevent genocide, to guard against the commission of genocide, and to prosecute, investigate and prosecute where genocide occurs. So you see very clear responsibilities on governments. I did have some meetings in Canberra where the Assistant Minister of Foreign Affairs said, well, Australia has now done something, which is recognize the state of Palestine. Good, I salute them for that. But much more should be done because it sends a very bad signal. If governments are not complying with the law, how can they ask citizens to comply with the law?
Chris, I want to bring you into the conversation. I read some comments that were published in Deep Cut News just earlier this week where you described international law as being in existential crisis. You also said that international law is just about the only thing standing between us and the abyss. I was hoping you could elaborate on those remarks for us and how you reconcile those two elements.
It is in crisis simply because the project that was commenced after World War II is a project that has taken 8 years to develop now a very comprehensive body of law. The law is good, but the systems for implementation and enforcement are very weak. In that area, really, after 80 years, we've only just begun. We have the International Court of Justice, we have the International Criminal Court, and we see already how difficult it is to convince states to abide by the decisions of the courts that, as Navi says, they themselves have established. And yet, where are we without international law? The body of law has been built to prevent precisely the kinds of things that happened in World War II. And that's why I say, without it, there is only the abyss. There is nothing else. And it is in crisis.
Rowan, you and the Australian Centre for International Justice, I guess the purpose of that centre is to try and seek justice and accountability through another avenue, through applying domestic pressure. I wonder if you can talk to me a bit about what your priorities are, what you see to be most urgent using domestic laws in Australia.
Yeah, I think not many people are aware that there is a role to play here domestically and not just advocating in international tribunals, courts, or the UN system. And that's because it's the state that has obligations and we have to ensure that the state fulfills those obligations. There are a number of things that we can do. Litigation is obviously one of them. My center worked with three Palestinian human rights organizations about 2 years ago to file the first arms challenge, which really was just an attempt at transparency because Australia is one of the Western states that has absolutely zero transparency in relation to its arms exports. So at the time, we filed in the federal court just to seek preliminary discovery of the permits that were sent after October 7th. You know, Australia had stated that they had stopped those exports. There's still issues to do with transfer back and forth for Australian sovereign capabilities. And of course, my centre, and I imagine most people here in the room, would be absolutely dead set against that because that is against the principle of what we would say it should be a two-way arms embargo. Regardless, we looked at, well, there's because, again, an issue of transparency, what else is the government hiding from us? Because, again, we just don't know what's going on. So we went back to them and we wrote on behalf of these organizations, three Palestinian human rights organizations, two that are based in Gaza and one in the West Bank, leading human rights organizations, which unfortunately have been sanctioned by the US government And we said, okay, well, we want to know about the current arms exports. And that forced the government into a review. And there's still zero transparency over that review 2 years later. And so we're looking again at what else we can do. And there's a number of other things. There's we're looking into monitoring the conduct of Australian citizens who are serving in the Israeli military. What we do is we monitor that conduct. We collate the evidence. We apply it to the legal framework and we make criminal complaints to the Australian Federal Police. That's the authority that's tasked with prosecuting these crimes, because not many people may know, but the war crimes and crimes against humanity and genocide are actually offences against the Commonwealth of Australia, that Australia has obligations to ensure that those offences are not just punished, but they are seen to be punished. And so what we are running up, what we're against here is political will or the unwillingness of authorities to actually implement the obligations that they have. But we also rely on movements in civil society and citizens all over Australia who have taken to the streets, who have boycotted, who have instituted divestments of Israeli investments in numerous sectors. So those are the sorts of things that we can all do here domestically.
Chris, I want to ask you, as we talk about accountability, about justice and about peace, a lot of that will rest on the collection, the documentation of evidence. And Rowan was alluding to this earlier. Israel continues to refuse access into Gaza for journalists, for human rights monitors, for yourselves as you were conducting your inquiry. How important is the preservation of evidence? Just as I was backstage, I saw that YouTube, a news report that YouTube has removed more than 700 videos for, I believe, Rowan, a number of organizations that you have worked with, Al-Haq, Al-Mizan, and a couple of other civil society groups that have been documenting abuses in Palestine. How important is it that both physical evidence in Gaza of alleged crimes and digital evidence is preserved and collected?
The collection of evidence and its preservation according to the rules of court is absolutely critical. Being denied access to Gaza, of course, has made our investigations more difficult. But that's not unusual. Most UN investigative bodies like ours are denied access to the scene of the crime.
Why?
Simply because governments don't want to have their actions criticised. They want to cover up. And almost every government seeks to cover up. That makes it hard, but it doesn't make it impossible. We're able to speak electronically to people in Gaza and have done so. We give priority to victims and to witnesses. There are many doctors, nurses, humanitarian workers, United Nations officials who have volunteered or worked in Gaza over the last 2 years, and we speak to them. They're not just talking as experts, they're talking as eyewitnesses to what has happened. And then, as you say, Noor, the digital material. We have either over 16,000 items of digital evidence, videos, photographs, satellite imagery. We're able to verify it, which is the first task, and then we're able to interpret it. And the interpretation involves military forensic experts as well.
Does it worry you that YouTube, Meta, there have been numerous reports of video evidence being taken down? And is there anything legally that can be done to stop that?
There certainly could be orders, but we try to preempt that anyway. When we see material, we collect it, we download it. So there was material going on the internet within minutes of the start of the Hamas attacks on 7 October 2023. And we were downloading that material literally within 2 hours of it starting to occur. And the same applies to the Israeli army. The Israeli Defence Forces are probably the most boastful about their criminal activities of any defence forces in human history. And they have been very generous in providing huge amounts of digital material for us. And we download that material, we verify it. If it's not verified, we reject it. If it is verified, we are able, under our terms of reference, to make that material available to the International Criminal Court and to other courts, and we do.
Navi, I want to ask you for your reflections, in particular on the issue around women. I recently read a statistic that two women have been killed in Gaza every hour for the last 2 years. I have been dismayed by the near silence from so many Western feminists about the atrocities being committed against the women and girls in Gaza. What can Western feminist movements learn from the struggles of the women from the Global South?
Well, they are all my friends, these famous Western NGOs. They get lots of funding and they would be out of work if they weren't focusing on our troubles in the South. I met many NGOs, for instance, in Kenya, and a lot of people from Kenya here. And they told me as High Commissioner, we like that these big NGOs are speaking on our behalf, but we would like to speak for ourselves. So what's also special about this commission that Chris and I serve on is that we did special investigations relating to what has happened to women. Because, you know, of all conflicts, it's very significant that this is the largest number of civilian women who have been killed. And then we compare that with what are the three things that the Israeli government is saying. They said they're acting out of their defense. They are after Hamas, and they want to rescue the hostages. So we compared those three military objectives to why women have been killed in such large numbers, why they've been sexually abused in such large numbers, the videos of which were posted by the perpetrators, the Israeli soldiers that Chris just referred to. And that's why we have them. So I know we always talk about women and children. I have to mention that what has happened to children is the worst ever, the largest number of children killed in any conflict. Doctors whom who testified before us at oral hearings told us that the children had been shot on the forehead and the chest. And this is why we call it direct killings of children. I would say that that's what's happened in respect of women and child victims. There has been no separation of combatants and civilians by the Israeli military.
Much of the media would have you believe that Donald Trump has a plan for peace in Gaza. That's despite the fact that only some months ago he was sharing dystopian videos of the so-called Riviera of the Middle East. I want to ask you about accountability, because that's a big gaping hole in that plan. What does accountability look like for Gaza? And are there any good examples of that having happened in history? And Navi, this is open to you as well. Chris, would you like to go first?
I'll go first. The 20-point peace thought bubble only contains one reference to accountability, and that is to provide an amnesty for Hamas. It says nothing about Israeli accountability, but it talks about amnesty for Hamas. Now, to start off with, that's rather weird. But simply put, there can be no peace without accountability. There can be no justice without accountability. No matter where I look, not just in relation to Gaza, I've done work, as you know, on Myanmar. We find in case after case after case that without accountability, we are destined to repeat the history of human rights atrocities. And that's why accountability is central, the kind of justice that Navi has referred to. That's why it's essential if we are really to achieve peace and justice. And ignoring accountability in the 20-point proposal, it's not a plan, it's at best a proposal. The ignoring of that means that it's not going to get off the ground in anything like the shape that it's in.
Navi, now that you are no longer shackled by the title as being chair of the inquiry, I wonder if I could get you to give us, I guess, your assessment of the Australian government's response and your recent trip to Canberra just earlier this week.
I think we spent our time mainly briefing parliamentarians, and those who pitched up there were friendly parliamentarians. So we didn't receive the kind of undertakings that we were looking for. I don't have the status to do that now. I did as High Commissioner for Human Rights when you did obtain undertakings and promises from governments. But nevertheless, our Canberra visit to me was interesting. Chris, you'll agree. In the interest shown in the report of the Commissioner for Inquiry on genocide. And I want to share with you that that's a two-year investigation by this commission as we gradually collected the evidence. It's there for everyone to read. You read the evidence, you look at the statements made by the leaders. We identified three as the most responsible: the President, Prime Minister Netanyahu, and the Defense Minister. I don't know why it's being interpreted out there that we are going after the entire Jewish community of the world. We're not. We named three individuals and asked for accountability. And I thought we received a good reception to our presentation of the report. And I wasn't expecting it, but I appreciated the opportunity of making this important investigation known to the Australian government. I hope it convinces them to take up what we call universal jurisdiction. You hold your national trials. If some of your people here have served in the Israeli military forces, for instance, and contributed to the crime of genocide, that would be a good point to start.
Please put your hands together for the 2025 Peace Prize laureate, Chris Sidoti and Rowan Araf.
And congratulations to Judge Navi Pillay on her achievements and for being awarded the 2025 Sydney Peace Prize. She was joined by the international human rights lawyer Chris Sidoti, who was also part of that UN Commission of Inquiry on the occupied Palestinian territory, and lawyer Rowan Araf from the Australian Centre for International Justice. The host was Guardian Australia's Noor Haider. They were speaking with an audience at the Sydney Town Hall. On Big Ideas, we bring you big thinkers at the best live events. In our next episode, summer is with us. That means the cricket is back. A pretty intriguing and unexpected end to the first Ashes Test. Tomorrow on Big Ideas, we're talking cricket, culture, controversy and history.
Long before I wrote about cricket, I played it and I still do. I have half a century of determined and resolute mediocrity behind me, prefiguring and influencing my intellectual investment in the game. Cricket narratives? I've known a few. I own some thousands of cricket books, thanks to a misspent youth, a misspent early adulthood, a misspent later adulthood, a misspent middle age and senescence. Do I discriminate between them? Of course, I'm partial to many of the books that Paul has invoked here, especially Aravinda Diga's Selection Day, Shahoon Karunatilaka's Chinaman, and also that delightful curio Bruce Hamilton's Pro. But very few cricket books contain absolutely nothing worth noting, even those triumphalist player stories that Paul identifies as cricket's stock in trade and types as narratives of success, recalling how players encounter obstacles in their youth but eventually overcome them.
Yes, popular cricket writer Gideon Haigh and English professor Paul Giles with an exploration of the stories we tell about one of Australia's favourite sports. That's on our next episode of Big Ideas with me, Natasha Mitchell. So great to have you company today. You can find and follow Big Ideas on the ABC Listen app to get all our podcasts and your feedback. Email us, bigideas@abc.net.au. We love hearing from you. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.